Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and this week we're talking about the apocalypse, or apocalypses. The modern world right now seems to be more on the brink of falling apart at the seams than ever before in my lifetime, and a surprisingly large amount of people are planning for it. We're going to talk about a survivalist movement that's been going on among billionaires and, I guess, 100 millionaires in Silicon Valley since Trump started winning state primaries last year. And we've covered on the site a few years back that our corporate and government overlords have been unnervingly active doomsday preppers basically all along and just not telling us about it. For good reason. I would have been 100% freaked out if I knew, for instance, that FEMA has spent, I think, $1.3 billion building secret apocalypse bunkers all across the United States to house government officials if the world ends. There was a giant underground bunker designed to house all of Congress in the event of a nuclear holocaust under the Greenbrier Hotel, which is this really nice hotel and tourist destination in West Virginia my parents used to go stay at on their anniversary when I was growing up. So, yeah, if a nuclear bomb had gone off while they were there, they would have witnessed all of Congress land there in helicopters and be spirited to a secret underground bunker. And if they tried to, follow the congressman because the air around them was starting to boil or whatever, they would have probably been shot on sight by the armed guards because it was a for Congress only bunker. There was only room enough for Congress, and they were so serious about the idea that the bunkers had isolation chambers for senators who'd gone crazy because everyone they knew and loved had died, and they were facing eternity with just a bunch of other 50-something white dudes. That's some grim shit, you guys. The post office and the IRS both have a section of their employee manual that covers what to do if society falls apart and, rule of law fails. The IRS employee manual has a chapter called National Emergency Operations, which says all employees from the accounting department down to janitors or up to janitors, I don't judge you janitors, all IRS employees would be reassigned as tax collectors, basically wasteland tax collectors in the event of an apocalypse, because apparently they think the first question we're all going to be asking in the event of a total societal collapse is, but wait, how do I pay my taxes now? Also, should we eat the fleshiest young people first or, do the right thing and save them for after we eat the jerks? Post office employees have instructions to burn all stamps in the event of a full-scale invasion of America so that, I guess, stamps wouldn't fall into enemy hands for some reason. And it's not just the government. I think the Vatican has a weirdly detailed alien contact plan. But CNN, specifically when it comes to the apocalypse, had a video package ready to go for the end times. I don't know how many people know this. I think some people do, but network and cable news channels have these pre-made segments ready to go in case an important event happens, like if a person dies. When I worked at ABC News, Pope John Paul II died, and they had a pre-made segment ready to go about his legacy, basically just needed to fill in the date and cause of death, and they had their first 30 minutes of programming after his death was announced. So if you searched HFR, which stands for Hold for Release, as in Hold for Release Until Cheney Confirmed Dead, if you searched HFR on the hard drive or video library or wherever they keep all their video assets at CNN, you'd see all the hypothetical celebrity obits and one video package labeled HFR Till End of the World Confirmed. CNN thought there was a good enough chance that the world would end that they produced a new segment designed to be played right before the bombs hit or the comet strikes or the entire country accidentally flushes all the toilets at the same time or, however we all end up going out. And it was one of the first videos they made. It's an old, grainy, early 80s era video of a military band playing the song Nearer My God to Thee, which is apparently what the band on the Titanic played as the ship sank, which would be a creepy as fuck way to learn that the world was ending. Anyways, I think I just always assumed that all these powerful people were just paranoid. But the more research I did for this episode, the more I realized that history and even the present day world are kind of full of apocalypses of all shapes and sizes. They just don't look like the apocalypse to us until we're in the middle of them. So yeah, hope you enjoy this conversation. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. All right, I am joined in studio by Mr. Alex Schmidt, a.k.a. Schmitty the Clam.
What up, what up?
And a first-time appearance, I think, from Sondra Sorensen.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, our PE crack reporter. She reports on stuff for us. She was the first person that we hired because she's a journalist who does journalism stuff. I seem like I know what I'm talking about, right? I'm nailing this. But a couple things made me want to talk about apocalypses today. And one of them was this piece that you've been kind of developing for us that's going to be coming out on the site in the next couple months about people who live in, I guess you would call them war zones, but it's really, really has the feel of like a post-apocalyptic movie a lot of the time when you like look at the details of what's going on in their life and what their day-to-day life looks like. Mm-hmm. And then we also had a couple recent articles, and we have just an entire genre of articles about apocalypses that could happen and have happened across human history. And so...
So if I can just get a date when the world is ending, that would be really helpful for my planning purposes.
I think the answer is it ends over and over again. What's that thing called? The Toba event or the...
Isn't there the Toba catastrophe?
Oh,
something?
There's the Toba catastrophe. Yeah. Is that the one where like there was only like 20,000 people left?
I might be off. I think there's one thing where there was like a massive explosion in Russia that was some kind of meteor
that
or something.
That might be...
But there's and then there's also in prehistory some kind of bottleneck where the human population crashed down to a few thousands, like you said.
Right.
And then that was it. We just kind of pieced it back together.
Yeah. So it's a thing that catastrophes happen, and we're going to talk about what those look like and how to live through them. It seems to be something that's just generally on people's minds. I don't know if you guys saw that New Yorker article by Evan Osnos from January about Silicon Valley survivalists.
Oh yeah.
It's like the richest people in America are all buying islands. They're buying land in New Zealand at a record pace because New Zealand has like favorable business laws. And also it's just really remote. And like they have like all these places built over there. There's like this subdivision where it's like 125 homes on 3,000 acres of coastal land that you can only get to from like private plane and like helicopter. The guy was taking Evan Osnos on the tour of this subdivision. He's like, the key thing is that you can't see it from inland. And that's important, I think, for us, for our privacy, but also for the public. And I was like, why for the public? Because they'll just be like mad or...
Right.
They don't want to have to see how nice we have it, I guess, is what he's saying. But but the whole idea is, it's like this place for American billionaires to go live once society collapses.
Right. He's like, when I say the public, I mean apocalypse marauders.
Right.
And that's going to be happening. So,
but you really have, you have like the founder of Reddit, Peter Thiel, doesn't talk to him, but he is one of these people who I think has... a will that like has really particular cryogenic things built into it, but also is like a doomsday prepper. And there's all these really wealthy guys who are like, my thing is I have like motorcycles and a bunch of ammo and I'm just going to go out into the woods and like kill anyone who comes after me. And like the Reddit guy just got surgery on his eyes, LASIK surgery on his eyes, because he was like, well, this would be a weakness. I don't want to have to be reliant on glasses and contacts in the apocalypse. But this is something that's like all coming together. And I think it's partially this last election and sort of the lack of respect for these sort of ancient institutions that are not ancient, but these really old and foundational institutions that our country is built on just stopped being a thing. People were just like, ah, nah, fuck you. The Republican Party, Trump's gonna be your candidate. And all these things that used to matter just stopped mattering. And I think that freaked a lot of people out, freaked me out. But I don't have billions of dollars to buy New Zealand. So,
well, I mean, disaster prepping in general is, it makes sense that billionaires would be leading that charge, because I used to live in the Cascadia subduction zone myself. And a few years ago, when that article came out, I think in the New Yorker about the big one, it became a trendy thing for us to all get together in our community and try and make some contingency plans. And when you sit down at the, and go through the breakdown of what you should have just for yourself, even if you don't have a family, that takes some investment.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty scary. Also, like, I really shouldn't have had a kid. That's the, like, all of these thoughts become, like, way scarier now that I have a kid. I'm like, ah, God. We should explain to people what the Cascadia subduction zone is, because that's the one that in our lifetime is probably going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I think it's close to 50%. I know it's 1 in 3 chance that it happens in the next some number of years. I know that's very useful for those of you living in the Cascadia subduction zone. But it's basically from the very northern part of California up to Vancouver. There's this kind of plate where the sort of continental shelf goes into the northwest coast of America. And basically the bottom of the Pacific Ocean is sliding underneath North America slowly. And
is that what subduction is? Like something ducks under something else?
Right.
Sure.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. It's the opposite of production, which is a movie. And they're saying, this ain't a movie, man. This is for real. So it's subduction. That's nonsense. But they found out about it because they realized that the plates were moving and all that stuff. But they realized how devastating this could be, because there's this tsunami that hit Japan in the 1700s or 1800s, the last time the subduction zone basically went off. This tsunami hit Japan. It was like called the ghost wave in Japanese lore, because it was just a tsunami that came out of nowhere and like wiped out a whole bunch of coastal towns. And they didn't have any explanation because there was no earthquake over there. But what they've discovered, or what they've kind of figured out, is that it was the Cascadia subduction zone all the way on the west coast of America. It was such a massive earthquake that it sent a tsunami all the way across the Pacific Ocean. And, you know, nobody who is still around and writing history was around at that time to tell us what happened. But you can like see there's like entire forests that are just, they're called ghost forests. A lot of ghosts in this story. Yeah. But they're 3 miles inland, all nothing but dead trees and just like standing up in the earth. And they've figured out it's because it was just like this massive tsunami. Like the west coast of America just dropped 300 feet into the ocean, essentially. And they think it's going to be the biggest disaster in the history of North America. And yeah, beyond Sandra's group of friends, a lot of Northwesterners are not prepared for it. That New Yorker article is fucking terrifying, though. People should check it out.
Yeah. Well, you also, Sandra, you also did the ultimate preparation by leaving town.
I did. Thank you, Kraft.
That was very skillful.
Thank you so much. Yeah. My parents are still up there, though, so I can't, you know, laugh too much about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Neither should I.
So the tsunami that took out Japan a handful of years ago was bigger than anybody thought was possible. And that's why it breached these walls that were like set up for anything up to an 8. And I think those earthquakes were like 8 point something, which is insane, because each decimal point when you get up that high is like magnitudes larger. So like an 8.3 is like twice as powerful as like a 8.1 or whatever. And they're saying that the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake would be like a 9 something. So it's like, it would be the most violent earthquake like on record, essentially.
Yeah, whoever worked out the Richter scale should have just done it on a like miles per hour kind of straightforward system. Because like the difference between 8 and 9 sounds like nothing and is world ending.
If you're not,
you didn't know? Yeah, that's to, like, those are might as well be different events. They're so different.
If you're not a detail focused, detail oriented prepper, you're going to be kind of screwed. Yeah. Actually, we had
Andy
a local paper.
Richter should have done probably.
Yeah.
We had a local paper in Portland. I can show you the article. They actually did a very Portland-centric breakdown of what it's going to look like and what buildings we're going to lose, which is almost all of them, and maybe the one bridge that's left standing.
Was it just like a lot of like unicycles washing around? And yes. Stuff, like Portland-focused.
Unicycles.
Sorry,
and
that's not nice. I mean, I make fun of Portland being quirky when we're talking about the entire city being like washed off the map.
It's really fascinating how many man-made and non-man-made ways things can go upside down or are going upside down. Like, there's so many ways to go.
Yeah, so many things to choose from.
Yeah,
Hollywood has so many choices for disaster movies. One really interesting article that not a lot of people read for some reason was this town in Canada that was completely evacuated because of a wildfire a couple years back called Fort McMurray.
Mm-hmm.
And we just interviewed a couple people who lived in that town and were there for the evacuation. And the article was sounded like being an extra in a disaster movie. And there's just like a lot of interesting insight that like I took away from that. Like traffic is like the biggest problem in a disaster because like everybody's trying to leave town at once. And so this like random Canadian town was just all trying to evacuate. And I think he said that he ended up going one block in like 3 hours because everybody was just backed up. Everything from like the highway back was just like all backed up. And, you know, the whole time, like there's this fire like burning down their houses around them as they're like sitting in traffic on their street. Oh, a weird thing that I didn't realize was that because phones are like flooded with like text messages and calls going out, you can receive texts and voicemails, but you can't actually get calls and you can't do any outgoing things at all. So, which seems like the worst because you see people freaking out and thinking you're dead, but like you can't say anything to them. But one really surreal thing was that they're sitting in traffic and one of the hosts on the radio who's like telling them about stuff just like lost his nerve and just left. And so there's just like dead air. So you like hear him panic and then he just like, I gotta get out of here, and like runs out screaming. Must have sucked.
Wonder if he got his job back.
He just gets to come back after. You're like, we're cool, right?
Right.
All right.
Hey, everybody, that was all right.
All right. Right. Where's the new studio?
Right. Getting gas took 90 minutes. Like, and that was before the evacuation, just like in the run up to it, which is crazy. And then just the idea of like having to get everything in your house, or like the things that like you can't do without. Like he got his marriage license, his insurance documents, his mortgage documents, passport, wallets, clothes. And I was like, yeah, I guess that's right, but I like wouldn't even know what I needed to get, really. It's a strange decision to have to make.
Yeah, and when you're not your most focused.
Yeah, exactly. It's like all I got were these Doritos. Damn it. Right. I was just like hungry at the moment. Yeah, but I have no idea what I'd take.
Yeah, who among us has our documents that organized at all times? Yeah. You know, not everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, when they tell you to make a bug out bag, they never tell you also have a list of these documents and know where they are for when you're fleeing your home.
Right.
Right.
Socks, he said, were way more important than he thought, just because that's the one change of clothes that like can get really funky if you don't have a change of socks. And also just like being in the traffic jam, the thing that stood out to him that I wasn't expecting was like how quiet it was because the power shut off because like the fire got to the power station before it got to his neighborhood. And so it was just all you could hear was like the fire in the distance like burning, but like you couldn't hear anything because I guess so many of the noises we hear just in our day-to-day life are power, you know, is electricity. And then the other thing that I guess I kind of assumed, but is still kind of a bummer, is just in the aftermath of a disaster, you have scammers kind of pouring in and like taking advantage of people. There were like all these companies saying they were like hiring because like all the businesses that burnt down, like they lost a bunch of jobs. So then all these companies come in and say they're hiring and asking for volunteers. And like the vast majority of them are fake and they have friends getting their identity stolen and like scamming the government for Red Cross money. And also just people got caught trying to break into a safe in a burned down house. It's just like, you don't necessarily see people at their best, you know?
No.
Yeah.
The safe makes sense. Those tend to be flame retardant, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But that's awful.
Yeah.
I get it, but that's awful.
Right.
Well, that's what I took away from it. Go for the safe in the burned down houses, yeah, is what I'm saying. Just kick around until you find a good one. And that's just a wildfire that like I hadn't heard of until we got that pitch. It's just like a literal apocalypse that was happening in a Canadian town within the past couple of years that like I just wasn't even aware. Existed.
And I mean, I hear there are huge wildfires kind of just annually in the West, mm-hmm, at least in the American West. And like, I'm living in LA, not from California, so I'll get that thing where relatives will call and say, hey, I saw on the news about a thing somewhere in California. Are you okay? And I'll be like, yes, the wildfire far east of here did not get to me.
Right.
But they're kind of happening all the time, it seems like. And I feel like it's not very reported or tracked. Or like if I was in the rural West, that's what I would be mad at cities about. Well, oh, these wildfires never get to Denver. They get to me, you know? Like, who's going to help? Who's going to do something about this?
And that's what this guy said, is that he was just like us in the sense that he was like, oh, well, that'll never get to me. And, you know, it was the fifth wildfire he's been through. But he wasn't worried about it until the morning of when they were like, oh, you know that town that is connected to our town? That's on fire now. So, like, you should probably get going. But up until that point, they were just, like, figured everything. It was going to be, like, all the wildfires before, and it wasn't going to hit their house.
Well, we almost had to evacuate once. I was living in Ojai, which is a town that's about an hour away.
Sure, yeah.
It's a valley town about an hour away from LA. And I was living with my parents at the time, and there was, I guess this would have been like 2006, the Pyramid Lake fire. And what just stuck out to me about that I was reminded of with the radio guy leaving his post, was that, you know, our ways of getting information were largely you'd go to the supermarket, and they had an information officer, and they showed where the fire was and we shouldn't worry. But then we turned on our TV and it was very sensationalistic, and we started packing our clothes and our photos and our documents. But then we went back to the supermarket to check, and he's like, no, it's fine, you guys, it's not going to get here. And you could kind of see the flames a little bit over the ridge. It's crazy.
Did it get there?
That's no, incredible. It never got to us. Oh, it didn't get to any of our friends, and it didn't get to the valley. But yeah, it was just, we had that moment of panic.
Yeah, I remember that being a thing that we ended up cutting from the article, but I think at the pitch stage, we were talking about sort of how the message traveled and how the story was covered on social media versus the actual media, and like that the news media was like freaking out, and then you got like kind of mixed messages, because I guess that's something like our movies have shown what it looks like on old-timey media, like TV and radio, when a disaster happens. Yes. But we don't really have, like, the cliche news version of that for, like, Facebook, like what it looks like on Facebook or, like, yeah, you know, or people freaking out and people overreacting to things. I'm sure that happens, too, but we don't really see that in movies just yet.
Well, I wonder if they had an information person at the grocery store, because it seems like that's the place people clear out as soon as there's any sign.
That's
of
a good point.
Anything like, oh, I need 100 bottles of water immediately. Yeah. Like that's is what they
not which so is, fast. Just get like 10.
Yeah. Which is not a bad idea if there's trouble. But
exactly.
You know,
it's,
yeah.
It's like, yeah, right. You just want all the water for yourself, sucker.
Because you know more than I do.
Right.
Information officer.
That's a thing that is common in a lot of the scenarios that we've talked about in terms of like things going kind of sideways in America, is that those of us who live in the city really take it for granted that we go to the grocery store and the shelves are just stocked with supplies.
Yeah.
And like all of those things are coming from out in the country. If there was any problem with either the supply chain or a problem with the people in the country or the people in the country got mad at us. I mean, not that that would ever happen, but decided to like stop giving us the food. That's one of the things that seems like it's common in every disaster is just bare shelves at the grocery store. Mm-hmm. We've done a couple articles with countries that kind of devolved into apocalyptic scenarios, Greece and Venezuela in particular, were countries that were doing extremely well, and then overnight their economy tanked. And, you know, you have these people who are living lives that looked exactly like your life if you live in the Western world. And the next day, there's like no food on the shelves of their grocery store. And whoever replaces the light bulbs and the traffic lights just stops doing that. So like the traffic lights like go out and they're just like, oh, well, now society doesn't work anymore. Like, what the fuck? But it's just the sort of thing that you kind of take for granted is going to be all right. And yeah, people have to do that shit. There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that I know that I take for granted on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah. And also, I wonder if just the optics of our lives in the wealthy West, like, make us think everything will be fine. Like, when I'm at a grocery store here, I keep thinking to myself, like, this is too much food. This is a billion onions and 100 boxes of pasta. And mm-hmm. this is so overloaded. How could this be? But I think from something Robert did for the site, he talked to a disaster expert and he was saying, like, yeah, well, there's about 4 days of food there. And if they don't keep getting supplies, it'll immediately be chaos. Like,
right.
That's it.
Especially those onions, man. I need my onions.
Why is that my number one food? Wow.
Like, yeah. Beautiful onions, just glorious shelves full of onions.
Right. I have a pantry of onions and dry spaghetti, and that's it. And I'm ready.
Today's episode of the Crack Podcast is sponsored by Blue Apron. Listen, not all ingredients are created equal. If you believed that they were, you are probably a very bad chef. I am one of those very bad chefs, or I was until I started using Blue Apron. What Blue Apron taught me is that fresh, high-quality ingredients make a real difference. So it's important to know where your food comes from. For less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers delicious, quality food courtesy of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranches across the U.S. Two of the meals they have prepared for this month include 1, sweet and sour salmon with bok choy and carrot and ginger fried rice. That's just one meal, and it sounds delish. And 2, baby broccoli and fontina paninis with arugula salad. So check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/cracked. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Again, that's blueapron.com/cracked. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. What are some other disasters that we've covered that might happen? I guess solar flares is one that's like a very targeted strike in that, I mean, it's not a strike. I'm giving the sun agency here, but it's basically the sun has an event that we still don't totally understand, but sort of an explosion, like a volcanic explosion that comes from inside the sun. And it's so powerful that it travels all the way across space and just like knocks out all electricity and all sorts of technology. Basically, it's happened. I think the last time it happened was in the 90s to a significant degree, but it's a pretty big deal. And especially because the last time it happened was so long ago, we're just much more dependent now on things like GPS and, you know, these things that would be taken out. And, you know, there's going to be planes in the sky and the GPS just goes away. That's not good.
There's at least one, I want to say it's War of the Worlds, there's at least one Aliens Take Over the Earth movie where it starts with, they used an EMP to knock out all our stuff. And is the sun doing that all the time?
The sun can do that, basically.
I keep thinking of that Simpsons thing where Mr. Burns is like, since time immemorial, man has wanted to kill the sun. we gotta take it down. It's out to get us. When you're talking about Greece and Venezuela, were those both cases where the disaster was just economic mismanagement? Like, there was no famine, there was no flood, there was no meteor, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it was just people screwing up?
Yeah, in Venezuela, it was like,
man,
they were over-leveraged on the... I think people might associate that with, like, oh, they were a socialist country, so, like, you know, they were corrupt, probably, and, like, spent all their money on AK-47s and parades with people marching in unison, but actually they have more fossil fuel under Venezuela than is under Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, any of those countries that we associate with fossil fuel. Venezuela has like the most basically in the world. So they realized this and were suddenly, for a period in the early 2000s, like one of the richest countries in the world. And rather than taking that wealth and diversifying their holdings and like investing in like technology stocks and all across the board, they were like, yeah, right, now, America, you want some of our oil? Well, screw you. You're not getting any. Like, they, you know, they have a fraught relationship with the United States. It was back when Chavez was around. And so they just doubled down on the oil. And since that time, oil prices have just like fallen. And, you know, this all of a sudden really wealthy country for like 5 years suddenly became way poorer than they were before. And they had all this infrastructure and stuff set up to be like a westernized modern world. And it just, everything went away. And Greece, I mean, Greece just fucked up.
And then there was India too. They demonetized on November 8th of last year. It was just this plan that the prime minister rolled out, and it was so poorly thought out. It was basically like, hey, we've got, he said, a lot of, I think he called it like dark money out there. Because what you have to understand about India is that 98% of all the transactions are in, or were in, cash. And so he said, you know, let's take the two most common forms of currency, like the two most common bills. And he went on TV at 8 p.m. that night and he said, hey, guys, by midnight, these two forms of bills are worthless, so you can't use them anymore. You can come to the bank and turn them in. You've got like 30 days to do it, but worthless because what we're going to do is we're going to roll out new currency with better counterfeiting measures, whatever. It's very complicated, but basically he was trying to force more people to pay income tax because only about 1% of the population does. But
is that a low amount?
I'm going to have to check my notes.
What do you people do? I don't pay any company.
Fashion mattress. Yeah. So, you know, he had reasons for doing it, but this whole, you know, you got 4 hours to spend the money you have was horrific to the people who were living in rural areas. I mean, it
basically, like, didn't have TV, so they didn't see his message. One of our sources for an article about this was like a college student, and he was like walking to class and looked over and there was like these like long lines pouring out of the bank. And he was like, what's everybody doing? Why is everybody in line? And they're like, oh, if you don't turn in all your money by like noon today, you don't have it anymore. Your money doesn't exist.
Yeah. And he didn't know about it because, you know, doesn't watch TV by, you know, he said he was kind of a hermit and his parents took care of all of his financial stuff.
Okay.
But our other source for this was talking about how, you know, he knew and he and his family just freaked out and pooled all the usable money they had and just, and then he was going on a motorcycle trip the next day. So he went on this odyssey through these different regions, running into every conceivable financial snafu you can. And so like some vendors just wouldn't take the money, even though they knew they could themselves turn it into the bank. Some vendors would give you credit, some wouldn't. And it was just, it's horrible. And then people are standing in line, like working class people are standing in line for 10 hours a day, several days in a row. There are a lot of associated deaths with this change because people were, you know, maybe not in the best health, but nobody else is going to stand in line for them. There was some domestic violence that resulted from the desperation of not having cash. It was just, it was crazy.
Although, jeez, the one good thing is that all those people who are like, ooh, I don't watch TV, they got screwed.
Yes.
And fuck those
people.
Never
say that again.
Yeah. Yeah. Look what that got you now, huh? Smarty? Think you're better than me? Yeah. It's weird because like reading this stuff, you find yourself siding with the people who watch Fox News and like are like all about investing in gold.
That New Yorker article about the survivalist tech pros is particularly fascinating because I feel like that survivalism is mostly associated with the opposite political spectrum kind of person. Like it's a rural person who is very militantly the opposite politics of those people, but equally believes because of the information they received that everything's going to end. And so it seems like it's weirdly nonpartisan to be convinced that you need to turn your home into a fortress on an island.
The fact that both of those sides are on the same page about this is harrowing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's scary because, well, specifically those tech guys, I mean, yes, there are many ways in which they're out of touch with reality, but they do have a pretty good sense of like how big systems work, and they tend to be kind of on the ball about certain things, and that seems to be a place where this is popping up. On the other hand, it could just be, well, those guys are all libertarians, and this is like a libertarian fantasy where like where everybody is frontiersmen with a rifle and a harem of women. We all have that fantasy, right? So, like, one of the studies that the Osnos article cites says that 40% of Americans think stocking up on supplies and a bomb shelter are better investments than a 401k currently. Which, I guess, that kind of says it all.
Well, you even see it in that new podcast, S-Town, which I'm not finished with yet, so no spoilers. But the main person they're following is well-versed in all kinds of apocalyptic theories on the internet and has a manifesto about it and brags about being unbanked and having his gold in various places.
Right.
And it is surprising how many people are convinced that the economy is kind of a fad. Like, this is going to go away at some point.
One thing that the Osnos article points out is sort of the alternate way you can go with this is that this has echoes in the late 19th century when a handful of, you know, robber baron types were getting extremely wealthy. It was when America got its first billionaire, and there were like these social tensions. We remember the Chicago World's Fair, like all the people being wowed by the technology there, but there were also labor disputes and like a lot of class issues that were being argued about. And the robber barons, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers at that time, rather than just being like, well, we better build a new country out in the middle of the ocean and get a bunch of Gatling guns, they were like, well, we need to invest in the systems that gave us all this wealth. So like Rockefeller built University of Chicago, and Carnegie built thousands and thousands of public libraries for the common people. And there's a bunch of people who Osnos interviews in Silicon Valley who kind of are like, maybe instead of being like, ah, I'm scared of those poor people, like I'm going to go hide from them in my mansion in the sea. If you're investing in armaments to fight off the hordes when society collapses, he was like, how much have you invested in your local food bank? How much have you invested in your local homeless shelter? Because if you're not investing in that first, then that's kind of an indefensible position to be taking. And that definitely makes sense.
Yeah, we probably should give some of these tech people credit for being people who are like now dedicating their time to trying to figure out how education should work and
right, things, right.
Know, or trying to figure out how to build a hyperloop between the Bay Area and here and
right.
You know, things that might potentially help us all. But even if some of it is self-interested in the sense that like, oh, I don't want to be devoured when the hordes come, you know, I want to have set things up so there are no hordes, you know, right. That's still helping everybody, I guess.
Whatever gets you there, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess, Sandra, the countries where you've been interviewing people feel like they're on this twin spectrum of terrorism taking society down, mm-hmm. and then in response to that, these like totalitarian governments kind of stepping in and making things awful for everybody. So Nigeria is one of the first countries where that you kind of investigated.
Yeah, in Nigeria, it was interesting the way that my source actually approached me about it. He said, people don't realize what's going on in Nigeria. It's kind of like North Korea. And then when he started listing that out, I said, well, I think we can make a comparison closer to home. because he was talking about, you know, the Nigerian president, Muhammad Buhari. You know, there's some Trumpiness to him, some Trump aspects. He sort of left the country for 3 months. So when I was interviewing my source, Buhari was still in London, supposedly, getting these medical treatments. And everybody thought he was dead because the only way that Buhari was communicating with his people was through Twitter. And he's actually finally returned, I think, last month to his country. But the message that was getting across from his absence was that he didn't want to be in Nigeria. And why would he? It's, you know, you have Boko Haram, but you also have...
Boko Haram is like one of the worst terrorist organizations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Except in Nigeria, or I think in the world, they've been outdone this past year by the Fulani herdsmen, who they're nomadic people and semi-nomadic people, and climate change has taken away their grazing land. So that's led to a lot of violent clashes in Nigeria. And I believe last year, their death count, in terms of the deaths that they caused, outdid Boko Haram significantly. So that's what you've got going on in Nigeria. And then you've got an absentee president who kind of, I think, prematurely declared victory against Boko Haram and then launched an offensive against a Boko Haram holdout, which turned out to be a refugee camp. So it's all this horrific mess, and it's very destabilized. So
right. So there's like no powerful, stable rule of law. And then you have these two terrorist organizations kind of attacking people.
Exactly.
And that's sort of, it's every man for themselves a little bit. It's kind of like the idea of return to the state of nature that you see in like zombie apocalypse movies. It's like
exactly
one of the details that stood out to me from in the words of your source from Nigeria is that every time I hear a loud bang, I listen for screams just in case. And like, that's pretty striking, you know, like if you hear a door slam or a car back up, you probably aren't assuming immediately that someone has just been shot.
Exactly. But there is this kind of interesting sense of community that he describes that not all of my sources described in other countries, which is that, yeah, you're looking out, you're hearing if there's suffering, but you're also looking out because specifically in his neighborhood, he lives behind a police station. So he described how if he heard, you know, the screams and the bangs, or if he heard a lot of car honking coming into the neighborhood, which I'll explain in a second, he would just take a ladder and jump into the police station yard and run in and get help. And the honking was that when they go out for supplies and they stock up for about 6 months at a time, which is quite understandable, it's not unheard of for muggers to just hop in your car with you and force you to drive to your home so they can burglarize your home. And you have no way of warning your family or neighbors. And so that's why they start honking.
Yeah, they have like a special knock or like a horn honk that lets people know that they're in trouble.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous amount of planning on a personal level, like figuring out exactly what to do in a lot of different situations and communicating with everybody about it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he has an exit plan with his girlfriend that's kind of arranged.
Yeah.
It's also interesting how quickly it goes to, like, every man for himself. He's like, there's a certain similarity about both plans in that if we know there's something wrong before other people, we will stay quiet until we're out of harm's way, because starting a panic won't help them and it won't help anyone. That's like an interesting thing that I'd never even thought about. If you like somehow know a thing's happening, I just automatically assume, yeah, I'd just like shout fire or whatever. But you might be dooming yourself and your loved ones if you don't just like keep it quiet, get out of there, and then shout back, hey, there's a fire in there.
Yeah,
it's as kind you're of, leaving.
It's like an oxygen mask on an airplane analogy. It's save right. yourself, and then you'll be more useful, whether that's in terms of getting help or, I don't know.
They know, like, specifically what they need. I think they said yams, rice, and beans. They just stock up on 6 months' worth of those at a time.
Absolutely, and even the yams are problematic because you need to refrigerate them, and electricity's in and out, but, yeah, it's pretty intense.
Have you guys read the Dave Eggers book, Zatoon, about the guy who's in New Orleans during Katrina? It's pretty good. Yeah, that's one of the things that the fact that you don't have air conditioning or don't have refrigeration, like all your food is going bad. So they're like having to get the food out of the refrigerator to cool places, like into the basement and stuff. And then everything's flooding. That's worth people's time if you haven't read that. And then you have a source in the Philippines where there's basically a drug user holocaust going on.
Yeah, so it's President Duterte, who basically ran and won on a platform of slaughtering 100,000 people. He just declared a war on drugs, which a couple of my sources, I only quote one of my sources in the article, but I talked to a couple other people who said, yes, it's definitely a war on the poor. Because it's a very bizarre system where supposedly if you're called out as being a drug user, you can surrender yourself and then you go to prison, an incredibly overpacked prison, and that's supposed to sort of save you. I don't know that there's really anything approaching rehab in the prison. You're just off the streets. But a lot of people, again, impoverished people who have turned themselves in and been released, they still have been murdered. And it's just these weird roving masked gangs of people that just will snatch men off the street or shoot them in their own homes. And it's seen as being very complicit with the government. Right. Often it's the police themselves who are doing this.
And it's like every time you kill someone and say, oh, they were a drug dealer, I caught them using drugs, or they were a drug pusher, that just wins you points with the government. So yeah. Like people are just doing that because it's like getting a tax rebate or something in America.
Yeah, it's incredibly frightening. There's obviously no due process. A lot of times, I guess users actually will sometimes be murdered by drug dealers so the drug dealers can protect themselves. It's just a mess all around. And what's really interesting in talking to people is I actually talked to, I think, 4 or 5 people from the Philippines about this. And there are a couple of them that prefer the system. Obviously, they're not poor. But they said, no, it's not him. It's not Duterte. It's really just the corruption that's been in our country. So that's something that Duterte keeps coming back to, is that even though he's clearly saying, I mean, he's got these sound bites saying he wants drug users, drug dealers dead. But really, he keeps coming back to how we're going to root out corruption. So he paused, I think, late January, he paused his war on drugs for a little while to root out corruption because basically they got in bad press. Police officers killed a South Korean businessman. So he had to react because it was, I don't know if it was just sort of a diplomatic problem or what the issue was. So he claimed, no, the problem is we need to root out corruption. These were very corrupt police officers. And so he fired someone really high up, but it's back to being what it was before. It's murders. And there was a very interesting quote from our source who we did quote in the article. He said, life in the Philippines, it's not chaotic for most of us, but hundreds still wind up dead each night.
It's like a quiet band of murder that's yeah. just taking place.
Because I hear, oh, okay, this guy ran on a platform of I'm going to kill 100,000 people, and he won. And then the, like, dark, funny question is, what did the other guy run on? Right. What was his opponent offering that people were like, nah, the murder guy, definitely.
Yeah. Let's go with the murder guy. So wait, their argument is that they like him because, not because of the murder, but because he's like anti-corruption?
Yeah. I guess there was a fair amount of street violence. And again, the people, the sources who are saying this, a source who's living in a more lower class neighborhood did not feel this way. But it was people who identified more as middle class who were like, yeah, thank God, you know. One of the sources said that Duterte is, quote, not actually the villain in the story. It's some of the people under him that pose a problem, like corrupted politicians that run local governments. I know not even Duterte can fix that. And then he's just like, don't piss off the cops.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's like bad because, yeah, it's those people's fault for like being like, hey, I'll get his attention and impress him by murdering them. Uh-huh. But it's his fault for being impressed by them murdering
yeah,
people.
He really set the atmosphere on that one. Right. Yeah.
The interesting thing with our source in the Philippines, he was from more of a middle class to lower middle class neighborhood. He was saying that you don't actually want to stay in, as opposed to everybody else we talked to who were like, yeah, you want to stay in or else you might get killed when you're out on the street by terrorists or by, mm-hmm. you know, whoever. He was saying you don't want to stay in because then you become suspicious. And if the police come for you, you're screwed. Whereas if you just stay outside and like kind of keep to yourself, you will keep a low profile.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really struck me having spoken to someone from Nigeria who talked about how helpful and supportive community can be. My Philippine source was very, you know, no, I actually don't get to know my neighbors, and that's good because you don't, you know, want to create any kind of feud. You don't want to piss anyone off because all it takes is a tip to the police, a false tip. So it's just very vengeful.
I'm sure some of my neighbors would have me killed if they could.
Yeah, I complain about noise a lot.
What did you do? What happened? What?
My dog goes to the bathroom on their lawn while I make unblinking eye contact with him. Let me just walk away. No.
Yeah, there is, looking at the quotes from this Philippine source, one part he just says, most people just lie low and avoid attracting attention when outside. That's how he describes daily life. Yeah. It's like, most people, when outside, shut down. Like, yeah. That's how society is at this point? That's right. Terrifying. Like,
I know. And can you imagine? I mean, I'm trying to imagine what my behavior would be, how I would change my behavior. I'd become a lot less passive aggressive. I'd let a lot more slide.
So it sounds like a great policy then. I mean, well, everybody's nice to each other.
Well, you just stop having a society, right? Like, I've read in general about people talking about how fascism rises in countries, and they say like part of it is society becomes atomized, which is a term for just individuals stop interacting with other individuals and getting to know them. And that it sounds like that's a big step toward everything falling apart is no one actually like talking to each other anymore.
Right.
Because they're afraid to.
Everybody's too scared to say anything. So nobody is like, man, I hate this. Do you guys hate this? This is fucking terrible. Like,
it's not just me, right?
These fucking Nazis are the worst, you guys. Because everyone's too scared to say anything. And like, there's always a chance that if you say something to the wrong person, they're going to be like, hate what? And then have you killed. So yeah, everybody just keeps their head down. And that's how bad people get away with bullshit. And then you talked to a couple of people from Syria, right?
I only quoted one person. And that was interesting, too, because he felt very similar to how our source in the Philippines felt in terms of you don't know who to trust. And there are multiple reasons for wanting to keep your head down. But he talked about how you have all these different factions. You know, you have your Sunni groups and your Shia groups, so Muslims and non-Muslims, pro-government and opposition, moderates and extremists. And at the same time, you're always at risk. Most men aged 16 to 45 are at risk of being drafted into the military. And my source, even though he identifies as atheist, is from a Sunni background in a Sunni town. And so he knows that if he were to serve in the military again, he's already been in for 8 years total. But if he were to go in again, that he would get the really shitty weapons and the horrible frontline assignments. And so it's kind of a death sentence.
Because of his beliefs? Because of like
Because Assad is Shia. So, I mean, so the ruling party.
Wrong sect.
Yeah.
And also I feel, I'm sure it also is just, I don't want to just start my career over and have to be like at an entry level job. I'm sure it's the same way in the military. Like, I'm like entry level military. They're just going to throw me on the front lines and give me the shittiest weapons.
Yeah, there's a lot of strategy that goes into that. He actually a couple times bribed, not a recruiter, whatever the version of recruiter we would have for someone who's drafting you, a draft officer kind of.
Right.
Someone called his house and during the day. And so he knew how to play it. He said he pretended to be his own father and said, the guy you're calling for will be home after hours. And what that means is that the recruiting officer can call back from his home line and arrange a bribe, which is what he did twice with the same officer. And that's worked for him so far.
Yeah, bribery seems to be a thing that becomes pretty important when society falls apart.
Right.
But yeah, just the lack of trust. Like he said, I barely trust people that I went to school with.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you put yourself out there and people see you and like even think about you, if enough people think about you, you're guaranteed to be on the wrong side for someone who has a gun. Yeah. So you just need to absolutely try and be invisible. And that sucks.
Invisible,
it's a terrible way to live.
Invisible and unarmed. He mentioned how he surrendered a hunting rifle he had in 2011 because he was asked to, because guns are typically in that area for the army and gangs only. So if you're found owning a firearm, you're presumed to be an extremist and you could be killed or jailed on site. So there's a lot of just, I think, trying to keep the peace and then really not feeling like you're terribly protected or can protect yourself.
That is definitely not what you hear about in America. You don't hear like the idea that you would be in a state of nature, post-apocalyptic scenario, and not want a gun. But that also makes sense that, like, you're making a target of yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, he also says that a lot of people who act friendly in times of peace will throw you under the bus to prove loyalty to whoever they need to impress, whoever's in power. If it's you or them, essentially, you can't even trust anyone who's not in your family.
Sort of like that kind of theme of social cannibalism that came up a little bit in the Philippines.
We spoke to someone in Iraq, but everything's fine for them, it seems. Yeah.
Well, I should say that I actually had two sources in Iraq. And, you know, given that I'm looking to speak to someone in English and someone who's tech savvy, I ended up with two college students, which was great. They were very informed. But I also think that, you know, I remember what I was like as a college student and the kind of concerns, parental concerns I would brush off. So they kind of have that casual fatalism that is, I think, largely just where they are in life and also from growing up in, you know, terrorism-torn regions. But I don't know that their outlook was just like, you know, you can't let this dictate your life. You still got to go out. I don't know that, say, the head of a family might feel the same way. Right. I don't know that they speak for kind of everyone in that region.
Yeah, because they're like, yeah, we fuck it. We go out. We still party because, like, one of them, we're used to it.
He's like, I don't drink as much as I used to because that's really frowned upon now. I mean, you know, it could get you killed. So he's like, before, you could find a restaurant and do it. And I think you still can, but it's probably not worth the risk.
That's actually something that just came up on the PE article on Monday, this idea that mental illness and substance abuse problems tend to go down in situations like this because, for whatever reason, like, people just, they're less likely to, it's like, maybe those can be diseases or problems that crop up when you don't have other things to focus
on. When your brain's not occupied with survival issues. Yeah.
Right. Because I assumed that, like, alcoholism would go way up in, like, stressful situations. But Evans was saying that they've done studies and, like, in the UK during the shelling of London during World War II, like, the fact that 100% of the population are casual alcoholics actually went down. Like, they drank less.
I mean, probably part of that might be, too, you don't want to let your guard down. You can't afford to be inebriated.
Or some of the people who do are killed.
Yeah.
That will drop the numbers.
I'm sure they took that into account. Yeah. Like, Bob's really cut down on his drinking since being blown up. Yeah, just one sort of seemingly insignificant detail, but that I think is a good indicator of how different life is in situations like this, is that in Iraq, he was saying that he keeps his phone at full battery at all times, because if you run out of batteries, then there are enough things happening on a daily basis that your mom or girlfriend is going to automatically assume you're dead if they call and it goes straight to voicemail.
Right.
So you just have to always keep your phone charged.
And actually, our Nigerian source said something similar. It's interesting because his friends will accuse him. He'll call his friends if he can't get his girlfriend right away. They'll be like, what, do you think she's cheating on you? And he's like, no, we live in incredibly dangerous times and I want to know that she's alive. Right. So he and his girlfriend do have this agreement that they also try and keep their phones charged, or they try and be accessible as much as they can.
Hey, let's talk about some wacky problems from history, you guys.
Yes.
Because there have been little minor apocalypses throughout history that you probably haven't read about, but that were seen as the global warming of their day. They were not as scientifically valid as global warming, but horse shit, the horse shit apocalypse that most cities thought that they were going to suffer. Alex, you are big into horse shit, I know. So.
Love it.
Love it.
Yeah, there was a time in the late 1800s where pretty much every wheeled vehicle was horse-powered. It was pulled by a horse. And in particularly big cities in America, like New York, there would just be an issue of how to deal with the shit that all the horses were putting out in cities that didn't have great waste management anyway. You know, and they had to figure out what to do about it. There would be an overall stink in the city that just kind of built up from it. And in the late 1800s, New York commentators were predicting that this would just be an endless problem that would never go away. Because just there's nothing you can do besides horses. So just as the city grows, there will be more and more of them. And there will be meters of horse shit filling our streets. I guess that's just what's going to happen. And they even tried to put together like a team of experts in 1898 at an international urban planning conference. They were like, we need to start doing these, let's do that. And in 1898, they mainly discussed how to deal with shit in cities, and they weren't able to agree on what to do. They just all got mad at each other and didn't come up with a solution and ended the conference. And that was it.
It would be like if the Paris Climate Conference had like ended after 2 days with everybody being like, fuck you, we can't like figure this out. And like, that's how hopeless things were.
Yeah, because they, right before that, in 1894, the Times of London was writing about what would happen in London because of the manure, and they just said, yeah, there will probably just be 9 feet of it in every street. There were people in New York saying that by 1930, the manure would be getting up to third-story windows in Manhattan. It would just pile up and people would just kind of roll with it, was how they thought I think it would work. And they basically solved the problem by coming up with electric streetcars and coming up with gas-powered cars. They didn't figure out a way to just deal with the manure that would work other than switching technologies completely.
Yeah, I mean, the way it sounds, it was like if you've ever been in a city during a snowstorm and there's like snowbanks up to the sides of streets that are like 6 feet high that you can like barely see over. It was that, but with horse shit, was like all the time. And it smelled terrible. And also another problem they had was that horses would just keel over and die because they were worked very hard. In New York City, in 1880 alone, New York City had to deal with 15,000 horse corpses littering its street. And a lot of time they would just be like, well, it's too heavy to drag out of here, so we have to like wait until it rots to pieces. And so that did not smell good. A lot of the ways they addressed the problem was just cleaning up the poop when it happened. They like put bags under the horses' asses and stuff. The stuff that you see on horse asses today, like in New York City, it was just a matter of like really trying to clean things up. People like hadn't really thought of that.
And even just sanitation was something that cities struggled with for centuries. Like when you read about especially like English lords, who it's like, oh, they live in London but they have a house in the country, it's not just because they're fancy, it's also because they wanted to spend part of their life in a place that didn't smell awful, because all of the human waste was going into the Thames and everyone could smell it all the time.
There was one summer in London that's famous for just the entire city reeking of shit, like worse than normal. Because like everything just smelled terrible for an entire summer.
Wasn't it like the Great Stink or something?
I think that's right.
I think there was at one point in the 1600s where there was one year where the whole city smelled like shit, and then either the year before or after it, the whole city burned down. Like, it was just a really difficult time to be in London.
Yeah, speaking of London, London fog is a type of clothing, and it's like an iconic part of London.
Are we doing a plug?
London fog.
Is this
the clothes you should wear if you want to get laid?
That's a good plug, man.
But that's a thing you always see in, like, if you watch a historic recreation of Jack the Ripper, or, like, supposed to be an authentic Sherlock Holmes, the city of London will be, like, bathed in fog. And it's, I always just assumed it was a weather thing, but apparently that fog was smog, like you have in Los Angeles up until, like, the past couple of years. Just, like, a thick kind of cloud of chemicals and smoke that hung around because they didn't have tons and tons of cars like LA does, but they had factories belching out black smoke and like just fires were clouding everything up. And in the 1920s, I think there was like a real problem, wasn't there? The Great Smog, I believe it was called.
It was 1952, yeah. Because England, especially in the north of England, is really rich in coal, like kind of how America or Venezuela or the Middle East has a lot of oil. England just had a lot of coal, and so they fueled everything with it all of the time. And in December of 1952, they had a mix of constant coal burning and a different weather pattern that just depressed the air a bit. And so for 5 days, London was just blanketed in a really, really thick, soupy smog. If you've ever seen The Crown on Netflix, there's one episode that's set during it where just the Queen and Winston Churchill have to figure out what to do with 1950s London being completely unbreathable. And it lasted for 5 days. It killed about 12,000 people and hurt about 200,000 people with like, various respiratory stuff.
To put it in perspective, like people were walking into the Thames, the main river there, because they couldn't see like more than a foot in front of their face.
Yeah.
And people were showing up to the emergency room, which you couldn't drive, obviously, because there was only a foot of visibility. So you couldn't like call an ambulance. So you had to walk to the emergency room, and people would show up and like their lips would be blue because they were like asphyxiating because the oxygen was so bad.
And it was all man-made. Like other than the air just did a thing that it does once in a while, and the existing crazy amount of coal pollution they had basically shut down the city.
Yeah. People like talk about how clean the air is compared to the 90s in Los Angeles, but you go up to like Will Rogers State Park and look at the city, and there's still just like a layer of yellow just sitting on top of the city. It's crazy.
Yeah, it seems like, I don't know, have roots here, but it seems, I don't know how this stayed a major city through a couple decades of terrible smog all of the time. I don't know how they did it.
I lived here in the early 90s, and I don't remember ever choking on smog, but I feel like I do remember air quality warnings.
Oh, yeah. And it seems like it was worse in the 80s, 70s, 60s. Yeah. Like it was just, they started to try to kind of figure out, like, because I've heard in the 70s, especially under Richard Nixon, greatest president, we did a lot of
a lot of
working on the Clean Air Act and the EPA and like trying to clean up air in the country. And LA was one of the big beneficiaries of it. Mm-hmm. But before that, like there's old black and white, but from the 50s and 60s pictures of LA where people are in little masks and like there's a really weird picture of somebody selling like balloons of air from elsewhere. Like, oh, and it's like kind of a bit, but also LA air was terrible.
It was labeled air from elsewhere.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I'm paraphrasing, but they should have done that. It's good marketing.
You guys have anything else you wanted to talk about?
There was a little ice age in Europe where...
A little cute ice age. Yeah. Little bitty ice age.
It was adapted into the film Ice Age, and it's adorable. It was a period of a couple centuries where all of Europe just got a lot colder, and it was mostly driven by volcanoes, from what I've read. So it's there just weren't enough people for it to be people's fault. But it particularly affected the Vikings in Greenland, or at least Viking Age people, I should say. Norse people settled in Greenland to mainly harvest walrus ivory, but also to farm and live there because it was somewhat green and it was not the frozen landscape we know of today. And the Little Ice Age just drove them out. And there's an amazing piece in this month's Smithsonian Magazine about people who were living there and then scientists who were trying to figure out if they just kind of left because it got colder or if they all starved there or both. And it was just a sudden shift in the world that wiped out a chunk of a society.
Yeah. Did you learn about that when you traveled to... Oh, no, you traveled to Iceland, right?
Yeah, which is a historically Norse place. But I was also... I try to correct myself really fast because I did an episode of Hilarious Helmet History, which should come out at some point, about the quote-unquote Vikings, which is a wrong term for Norse people in that time when there were Vikings running around. Because Viking is a job title. It's a raider who goes out from Norway or Iceland or someplace like that. But so I was researching that and digging in particular into Greenland because it was sort of a stepping stone for their sailors to get to Newfoundland and to North America. But then it just stopped being a place people lived all of a sudden.
Because of the Little Ice Age?
Yeah, they think it was a combination of the Little Ice Age and Europe discovering that they could get ivory from places besides walruses way up north. You could get it from elephants and things like that. And they also thought it was possibly to do with the Black Death. Like, just a lot of horrible things happened at once, and then no one lived in Greenland anymore for a long time.
Yeah, so if people can take away anything from this podcast, you can get your ivory from elephants. Don't worry.
It's another plug.
Yeah. Ivory.
And nobody lives in Greenland, so if you don't have New Zealand bomb shelter money, give it a shot.
Yeah.
Might be kind of cheap real estate.
Yeah. I'm sure you can hack it in the Greenland wilderness. All right. That was our episode. Hope you enjoyed it. Since we recorded it a couple weeks ago, things on my Twitter feed have gotten even more apocalyptic. Fortunately, it's been great. People just assuming North Korea was going to murder us all after our crazy hair trigger temper president tweets something about their leader's weird haircut or some dumb bullshit that kills us all. When you go back and read about all the apocalypses that were narrowly avoided during the Cold War, it makes the present day world pretty terrifying. Like, there's a bear that breached a fence at a super sensitive, high-security military base, and they thought it was an attack or it somehow tripped the alarm that said, like, nuclear strike incoming, and U.S. bombers were speeding down the runway to take off and go drop nukes on Russia because that bear had triggered some crazy series of alarms. And somebody, like, drove up in their car, like that scene in the movie where they drive up next to a plane that's about to take off and, like, wave them down. That happened and is the only reason we're still alive. There's a guy, Stanislav Petrov, who is a Russian man who was at the controls when what appeared to be a U.S. nuke popped up on the radar, and then another, and it looked like a full-out attack. And the only reason our planet is still populated by anything that's not a cockroach is that this guy, Stanislav Petrov, refused to do his job. His job said if this thing that was happening happened, he was supposed to launch all missiles at the U.S. And something about the radar didn't seem quite right to him, or he, I guess, kind of chickened out, or maybe something didn't seem quite right to him. But it was like exact textbook, if this happens, you fire back. And he didn't. And after a couple minutes, the blips disappeared and they realized it was a one in a million misfire, I think caused by either a flock of geese or like the angle of the sun. If it's not the angle of the sun, then there's a different time that we almost all died because of sun coming in and like hitting a sensor at a weird angle. But I think with Petrov, it was a flock of geese. Anyways, something tells me that currently we're constantly being saved as a species from utter annihilation by, you know, similarly trivial bullshit just every day at this point. Let's move on to footnotes before I begin to openly weep. We're going to link off to a Cracked article about nightmare apocalypses humanity forgot were possible. We're going to link off to a piece called Real Cities Destroyed by Incredibly Bizarre Apocalypses. Another Cracked article called Apocalyptic Scenarios Society Says We're Overdue For, and a final Cracked article called Horrifying Apocalyptic Scenarios That Have Already Happened. Then we're going to link off to a bunch of New Yorker articles. One is the one I kept talking about, Doomsday Prep for the Super Rich. We're going to link off to the New Yorker article from a couple years back called The Really Big One, about that Cascadia earthquake that is supposed to just demolish the Pacific Northwest at any moment over the next 50 years. We're going to link off to another Cracked article. I was lying when I said the last one was the last one. It's called Evacuating a Modern City, Realities in a Real Apocalypse. That's the one about the Canadian city that burned down, and it just has some of the most striking and bleak apocalyptic imagery that I would have ever seen if it were a movie, and it actually happened to these people. We're going to link off to the page for Dave Eggers' book, Zaytoon, and a New Yorker piece called Hosed, which is about climate change, but it starts out talking about the problem of horseshit in the streets of New York City and just how hopeless our smartest people thought that problem was. And finally, an article from Smithsonian Magazine called Why Did Greenland's Vikings Vanish? That Alex assures me is a really good read. And that's going to do it for this week. Thanks to engineer Brett, as always, who you can follow at Brett, R-A-D-E-R. You can follow me at Jack_O-B-R-I-E-N. And we'll be back next week with more podcast. Talk to you then.
Hey, so it's Sean and Hayes from Hollywood Handbook. We just want to apologize for
whatever you just listened to. I think we can all agree that sucked.
It sucked.
It sucked. It was terrible. It wasn't a good podcast. So if you want to listen to a podcast where you're laughing, having fun,
and
two of your best friends,
and a show that's actually smart,
and
because
it's smart.
One of the things that what you just listened to, not only did it suck, it was stupid.
Stupid for babies. A grown-up smart podcast that's funny that keeps you awake is a show called Hollywood Handbook. It's hosted by your two best friends, Sean and Hayes, and we are your friends in real life.
Yes. Unlike the people that did this show that you just listened to.
They're just doing it so
yes,
that you'll like.
They don't want to be your friends, and we already are.
Yeah. So don't listen to the sucky show that you have. Do the new show. We're doing it. It's Hayes and Sean, Hollywood Handbook, and find it on Earwolf or something.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.